Hello and welcome to Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo. I'm Ryan Bickle. On today's show, we have a very special guest from the Neil Smith Prairie Restoration, National Prairie Restoration Area. I probably didn't get the name exactly right, but we have a guest, Patrick, from there, and he's going to tell us all about the prairie out at the Neil Smith Refuge. And so Jesse Lowry is also here. So Jesse, why don't you get today's show started?
Hey, Ryan, thanks so much. I am the Director of Conservation and Research, and you almost got it right, Ryan, and you got closer the second time.
I got closer the second time.
Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge.
Oh.
And for the first few years, I would always forget national. And so, yeah, it's Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge. Patrick, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
It's an awesome place.
We're not very succinct, but...
It's a mouthful, but that's okay. It's an awesome place. We're excited to have you here, Patrick. I always like to start off the show by just kind of setting the stage for a minute here and talk about the role of AZA-accredited zoos or modern zoos. The mission of Blank Park Zoo is to inspire an appreciation of the natural world through conservation, education, research, and recreation. I see it as a window to the wild, a place where we want to invite the community to come in and have a great, fun day out with your family. But while you're here, we want to inspire true conservation actions. We want to inspire people to take action in their own life that's going to help out wildlife and wild places around the world. And so Blank Park Zoo does that in a multitude of ways, but it really boils down to that a portion of every single dollar that we make here at the zoo goes to save animals in the wild in the range countries of where they're found naturally. So we give funds to Giraffe Conservation Foundation in Namibia, International Rhino Foundation in Indonesia, Hornbill Research Foundation in Thailand, and so many more. You can find out more about the conservation projects that we support, of course, on our website, blankparkzoo.com. But I always say that if you want to get the most bang for your buck, as far as conserving wildlife is concerned, doing things locally is the way to go. And we started our plant grow fly pollinator conservation project in about 2014. And you guys were, Neil Smith, you guys were the some of the first people that we reached out to because we really see you guys as the gold standard in habitat restoration.
Oh, well, thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome, Patrick. And you and I have worked together for years. And it's just been really fun to see all of the attention that pollinators are getting, honeybees and monarch butterflies, of course. And so just welcome again to the show, Patrick. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your role at Neil Smith?
Sure. So as you mentioned, I work at Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge, and we are one of over 500 national wildlife refuges all across the country, and ours is focused on prairie. So my duties as a park ranger vary drastically depending on what the day is. So I'm lucky to be able to do a lot of different things, whether that be education, working in our visitor center with different groups that come in and visit, or like you mentioned, Jesse, getting to do some pollinator gardens throughout the community. So get to do a little bit of everything, and that's probably my favorite part of my job.
Yeah, you have a really awesome job. And I have to ask you, did you always want to be a ranger when you grew up?
So it's funny you should ask that. So I didn't fully understand what a ranger was when I was younger. I did love Steve Irwin. He was kind of my go-to guy because I thought, man, if you could wrestle crocs all day in shorts, that's what I wanted to do growing up. So he was kind of my model, but I didn't fully understand what a park ranger was. So I actually was going to be a teacher, and, you know, as it would turn out, I did turn out to be a bit of a teacher just about nature.
Yes, yes. So tell us a little bit about the history of Neil Smith. This is my favorite part.
Yeah, so one of the most interesting things is that people don't know what was supposed to be here initially. So back in the 80s, this was actually being considered the land that Neil Smith is on. It's being considered to be a nuclear power plant.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so drastically different from what it ended up being. I think it was a mixture of nuclear power falling out of favor and just the plan not being as feasible. The Des Moines area didn't grow as much. They didn't have as many power needs. So power company was left with all this land that they didn't know what to do with. Well, Congressman Neil Smith at the time was interested in trying to create some kind of prairie reconstruction. So he was a very passionate advocate for the history of prairie, which people may or may not know. It used to cover more than 80% of the state, and now it is less than 0.1%. So Congressman Neil Smith thought it was very important to have some representation of what Iowa's natural landscape used to be like. So he actually met with the power company, said that Congress would be interested in purchasing that land and establishing some kind of national wildlife refuge for it. So
wow,
really cool history.
And it was farmland, right?
It
when you
was
guys converted it
correct.
To
so
okay.
Prairie City was the vast majority of it was row crops, so like mm-hmm. corn, soybeans. So we've got a really cool picture in the visitor center of it's what it looked like pre-90s, so we were in 1991, and it's just rows of corn, and then a picture of it now, and it's just such a stark contrast.
Yeah, and that's what I love about Neil Smith. I always say, you know, don't let perfection be the enemy of good. And what I mean by that in regards to prairies is that you don't have to be a remnant prairie. You don't have to be an original prairie to have this amazing, amazing biodiversity. And just to know that we can put back the building blocks of an ecosystem like you have done at the refuge is an amazing model, I think, for all Central Iowans, whether they're putting in just a backyard pocket prairie or they've got some land that they want to put in CRP. It's just a really great resource, an example of really what can be done.
Absolutely. Every little bit helps, and you can always change things. It doesn't have to be like we do have that remnant prairie and we do have some of those pockets, but the vast majority of what we have here is reconstructed prairie, and that's great.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of the diversity that you have on the refuge, both plants and wildlife.
Oh, so one of the cool things about tall grass prairie is you get such a diversity of different flowers. That's probably one of my favorite things to see.
Me too.
We're really starting to see a lot of that come up right now. And it's really fun to see the changes throughout the season. So we've got an oak savanna area on the refuge that in the earlier months we get to see things that bloom in more shaded areas. So that's really cool. It's a great spot for birds. We get all sorts of migratory birds that come through. And then later in the season you start to get kind of the prairie in full bloom. So we're starting to see that with our milkweeds blooming. It's just really cool to see butterflies coming through. We've got all sorts of different kinds of insect species. And probably our crowning jewel would be our resident bison herd.
Yes, tell us more about those the biggest animals on the refuge.
So we have a herd of 66 bison. 11 calves were born this season, so very cute. Highly recommend coming out and watching them frolic around. And
wonderful.
They are in an 800-acre enclosure throughout the refuge, so something that visitors love doing is they can actually drive through that enclosure, and depending on where the bison are that day, you can get so close to them that they're actually blocking the road. They're sitting there right in front of you, and it's something to see, just a 2,000-pound animal just kind of walking along and thinking that, wow, there used to be millions of these throughout North America.
Are they self-sustaining, or do you have to supplement their feed?
So that's a great question. So we're very hands-off with our herd. The only kind of care that we do is once a year we'll do what's called a bison handling event where we can take DNA samples so we can check the genetics of the herd, and then we can also monitor for any diseases that might, you know, have a really detrimental effect on the herd as a whole. But otherwise, they're mostly self-sustainable, so we don't do any food unless it's like severe drought conditions or anything like that. Since new calves are born every year, we do send yearlings, a certain number of them, usually every year, to other refuges and herds across the country. So we're kind of like a feeder herd in that regard.
Where did the bison originate from?
So our bison are from the national herd out west. So that's where the vast majority of federally managed bison come from.
Wonderful. And Can you tell us a little bit about why you have bison on the prairie and as bison as a management technique?
Sure. So bison actually have a really interesting history with the prairie in that they used to be a kind of nomadic species that would move throughout the prairie and graze along it. And a really cool thing that has to do with the prairie flowers is bison do what's called wallowing. So on a really hot day, they'll find actually a mud depression and they'll roll around in it. And what's really cool is that as the bison are walking through the prairie, they can get seeds stuck to their fur. And so as they're rolling around in that mud and grinding down with their fur, they can actually plant some prairie seeds. So they've got a very unique relationship with the prairie in that even just something as simple as rolling around in the mud can have profound effects on the flowers that are available in the prairie. So some are actually very good at sticking to bison fur, and that's actually a very good way for them to continue their life cycle.
I love that. My 5-year-old daughter likes to roll around in the mud. Would you like her to come out to the refuge?
There you go. We'll see how she does versus the bison.
We'll do a little research project.
Yeah.
That leads me to my next question. So you can have bison on the prairie to kind of help manage the prairie landscape. Can you tell us a little about burning as a management practice? Because I know you have some experience with that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's something that most people kind of scratch their heads at. What, you light the prairie on fire? Well, how could that be good for it? So something that's unique about prairie plants is that they have extremely deep roots. So anything you're seeing above ground, you've probably got at least that, maybe even 1.5 times that underneath the ground. So
wow.
10-foot prairie plant could have 15 feet of roots growing underground. What that means is that it's very easy for them to regenerate after a burn. So if we light the prairie on fire, if we burn out all the dead growth from the previous year, that prairie plant has so much of its stores built up in its roots that it's going to easily come back. Whereas things that might not belong in the prairie, so maybe some invasive weeds, some trees, things like that, don't have that kind of adaptation where they can come back. And fire is actually a really good way for controlling a lot of those invasive species.
That's amazing. So what kind of considerations do people need to keep in mind if they want to put some prairie plant species in on a much smaller scale, at their church, at their place of work, or at their home? Because I would guess that these plants are pretty used to, you know, behaving in a certain way with lots of other tall grass prairie plants and you know, open landscapes.
You're correct. And prairie plants, they're wild plants. They want to grow. They grow tall. They spread out. Usually, if someone's interested in doing a native garden, there's certain species I like to recommend. So there are species that are going to be smaller, a little more well-behaved. So a lot of people really like growing milkweed, and I love common milkweed because it is very good at growing and very good at spreading. So if you're trying to fill in an area, common milkweed's great.
Mm-hmm.
Can be a little challenging if you've got a small garden and you don't necessarily want it to spread. So there are actually other kinds of milkweed that are a little more well-behaved, a little smaller, not as prolific. So like a butterfly milkweed, beautiful, beautiful orange blooms. We're seeing it on the prairie right now. And that's a really popular one that's a little bit shorter, a little bit easier to maintain in a smaller garden.
And I also love swamp milkweed. It's just
gorgeous.
Oh, that's
gorgeous. A gorgeous one, too, and it smells delicious. Smells amazing when it's blooming.
Yeah, it smells like cotton candy, I think.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Tell us about, besides milkweed, give us a couple more examples of some flowers that you would recommend for a backyard.
Prairie clovers are actually really pretty ones. So there's a purple variety and there's a white variety that grow native in Iowa. And they're shorter species. They've got kind of delicate little pine needle leaves. And they've got a nice cone of really bright pink or very bright purple and white flowers. So,
yes, I do love that. I love that species as well.
There's actually a prairie petunia as well that grows very short to the ground and looks like a regular run-of-the-mill petunia that you could get at the greenhouse, but it's a native adapted one. So those are a really cool one to plant as well.
So why are these plants so important to pollinators like bees and butterflies?
So if you think about a plant that you get at a greenhouse, a lot of the times they're grown so that they have the they bloom the longest time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe nectar isn't necessarily their most important factor. So if you have something that's coming to feed, is collecting pollen, is collecting nectar for food, it might not be a great source for that. So even though it may look really pretty and it might bloom longer, it might not have the food required for pollinators in order to survive and carry on their life cycle.
Yes. And so it's really important to get plants from trusted sources to make sure that they are a native plant and not a cultivar, and that they're organic and they haven't been insecticides or other chemicals haven't been applied. You know, when you're trying to really make this oasis for these beneficial insects in your yard. Now, Patrick, one of my favorite things about talking with you is your expertise in bees. And a couple of years ago, you told me a story about some kind of landing pad that bees can see on flowers. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, I can. So there are actually some kind of flowers that have different lights, so light frequencies that we can't see, that kind of point them in the direction of where to find nectar. And it's just the craziest thing. If you put these under, like, ultraviolet light, it's like something that might look kind of plain and normal all of a sudden just lights up and it looks like a runway saying, yes, this way to nectar. And just such a cool adaptation that a lot of these flowers have made. So if they've got a very particular pollinator that they're trying to attract, it's just another way that they can say, yes, come this way.
And is it true that sometimes that little landing pad will kind of disappear after that particular flower is pollinated?
Yeah, so once it doesn't have any reason, once it's already been pollinated, that can kind of fade, and it's not something that's as important. So really cool.
That's wonderful. I just watched a documentary on hummingbirds, and they were talking about how when a hummingbird goes up to a huge flowering bush, that they mentally can remember exactly which flowers they have visited because they need to collect nectar about every 15 minutes to fuel their energy needs.
Can you imagine living like that, having to eat every 15 minutes? You'd have to have a good memory for something
like
that.
Yeah, because if they went to the same flowers that they had gone to earlier in the day, they would waste too much energy. And one more little tidbit, 80 wing beats per second for hummingbirds.
It's a really fun activity to do with students, particularly when they have lots of energy, is have them see how many times they can flap their arms up and down and then compare that to a hummingbird.
I love that. So we can extrapolate how many wing beats per minute and then just have the kids flap their wings for 60 seconds.
Yep. Great way to burn some energy.
Hey, I really like that.
I think I could try eating every 15 minutes.
that would be easier than the flapping.
Okay, so we're going to wallow in the mud. We're going to eat every 15 minutes. Yeah. This is a good podcast. I like it. So can you talk a little bit about some programs and some events that you guys have going on at Neil Smith?
So the biggest one that we're gearing up for is Petal the Prairie, and that's happening this Saturday.
So, and what's the date on that?
The date on that is Saturday the 29th.
Okay.
And that runs from 9 o'clock until 1 o'clock.
Okay.
So a cool thing about Neil Smith is our entry road, which is a paved, beautiful, windy road, takes you through the prairie hills, has a bike path. So year-round, people can bike, but once a year, we'll actually close down the road and invite bikers en masse to come and pedal the prairie. And it's a really fun event. We have vendors that come out, different conservation organizations. So not only is it a great way to tour the prairie, it's also a really fun family event as well.
That is fantastic. Bicyclists are such a great demographic, and they're nature people and outdoors people. And Ryan, you ride a bike. Have you ever been out to Neil Smith?
I have not ridden my bike out there, but I have been out there and hiked. And which leads me to the question I have for you, Patrick, is every morning I bike, I see all sorts of native wildlife. And I want to know what type of animals are attracted to the prairie that, you know, like you talk about the buffalo, but that's sort of a managed species that we planted there. But what other wildlife do you see out there?
So one of the more prominent ones I'm starting to see now and that we're actually searching for is monarch butterflies. So that's a really popular one, especially with all the blooms that we're having right now. The prairie is a great source of milkweed, which is required for monarch caterpillars to eat, and so they can complete their metamorphosis. So that's a really cool one that we're seeing. All sorts of different kinds of bees. Birds are really popular on the prairie right now. We've got resident dickcissels, meadowlarks, all sorts of different things. So it's a really kind of a smorgasbord where, depending on what kind of thing you're interested in, you can probably find it on the prairie.
Yes. And whenever I talk to people about planting a butterfly garden, I always remind them that if you want to see more butterflies, that's a great thing to do. Bees, that's a great thing to do. And birds, because a lot, especially chicks, will eat insects as their main diet. Doug Tallamy, author of Bringing Nature Home, always tells a statistic that for a chickadee, from hatching out of the egg to fledging the nest, which is just a couple of weeks, they are fed 6,000 to 9,000 insects, and over 90% of those will be big, fat, juicy, protein-rich caterpillars. So it's all about putting those building blocks of the ecosystem back together.
Yep, everything is built off of each other. So if you've got a favorite mammal or something, you need plants, you need insects, you need all of that to get up to that point.
Yes, and back to, just the particular plants and how they support the insects. Another thing that I always like to tell that Doug Tallamy told me is, you know, when you think about all the oak species of trees put together, they are the host plant for, I think, about 550 different species of insects. And then if you look right next door to maybe a ginkgo tree or some other exotic species that is not native to the United States, of course, that's going to be the host plant to zero species. And a lot of these native insects literally do not recognize these exotic plants as anything that they could use for their habitat or their food. So it's important just to start putting those native plants back into the landscape, because we need to provide nectar and host plants for insects every single place that we can, especially when we're talking about the monarch butterfly. Can you tell us the story of the monarch butterfly, both in its life cycle and its amazing migration?
Absolutely. So monarch butterflies are unique in that their caterpillars can only eat one type of plant, and that is milkweed. So the entire time that they're alive, they will be munching on different kinds of milkweed plants. And then once they've grown, they've actually got several different stages called instars. They will form a chrysalis, then they will emerge as a butterfly. So the adult butterflies go on a massive migration down south to Mexico and overwinter in fir tree forests down in Mexico. And they will stay alive for that period, and then they kind of stair-step their way up once spring comes and start making their way back up North America. So it takes multiple generations for monarchs to get up to Iowa. So a lot of people might think, oh, that's the monarch that was overwintering. Well, probably not. It's probably might even be on a third generation by then, but they do, once they make it up to Canada, those surviving monarchs are what's called the super generation, so they're actually bigger, stronger butterflies that'll make the long flight down to Mexico.
It's such an awesome story, and when they do arrive in Mexico, it's right around the Day of the Dead festival, and there's a folklore that the returning monarchs are their fallen ancestors returning home, and I just always love that. Can you talk a little bit about, well, first of all, I want to just mention, you know, that we have partnered with Neil Smith for years, and we got this grant through Association of Zoos and Aquariums this past year for their Zoo Park Partnership Program, really to just kind of more formalize our partnership and deepen our partnership. Over the years, we have worked on pollinator and prairie programs. You guys have donated thousands of native plant plugs, and we've restored many different areas of the zoo. We've joined the Good Neighbor Program at the University of Northern Iowa to sign a pledge that we will not blanket spray herbicides or pesticides over our grounds at the zoo. And all of these things are coming together to just really help make more space and more habitat for pollinators. And so we just really, really cherish our partnership. And later this year, we have a couple dates, I think in July and September as well. We have some stewardship days where we can and where we want to recruit volunteers to come out and work in the prairie. And we've just got a couple minutes left. Can you tell us, when you have volunteers come out to Neil Smith, some activities that they might be doing?
Sure. So we're just starting to end the planting season, so it's getting a little hot, but we, in the early parts of the summertime, we'll do prairie planting. So some of those plugs that you mentioned that we grow will actually go out and plant on site. And then now we're starting to transition into the seed harvesting phase. So we've got some groups coming in. I believe we've got our second Saturday stewardship on July 13th, and then we've got a Wells Fargo Green team that's coordinated in partnership with the Zoo Park Partnership, and they're going to come out and collect some spiderwort seed for us.
Oh, spiderwort is one of my favorite plants.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous one.
Yes.
And that's blooming right now, so people will be able to see that if they pedal the prairie.
Perfect. We've got about 2 minutes left. Can you tell us, Patrick, what inspired you to be the amazing conservationist that you are?
So I grew up and I loved spending time outside. And when you're a kid, you don't really think about the quality of the area that you're in. So mm-hmm. I hung out in a creek that in hindsight was very polluted. And that didn't so much matter to me. But as I got older, I realized that, you know, that pollution could ruin that creek. It could make it so that future kids like myself wouldn't be able to enjoy it like I did. So that kind of instilled in me the importance of conservation. And it's one of the reasons that organizations like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are so important, because they are safeguarding and conserving America's public lands for future generations. So I just can't think of a more noble goal than making sure that future generations of children can enjoy all the different landscapes that we have across this country.
That sounds great. Tell us the easiest way to get there, and what are your hours of the visitor center and all that good stuff, and we'll wrap this show up.
Sure thing. So if you're coming from Des Moines, the easiest way is to take Highway 163 to the Prairie City exit, and then we've got it, as I mentioned, that nice windy paved road that takes you to our visitor center. So the visitor center during the summer season is open 7 days a week. So it's open Monday through Sunday, and it is open from 9 o'clock until 4. You can be on the trails. You can be on, we've got an auto tour route that goes through the bison enclosure. Those are open so long as there's sunlight.
That sounds great. And thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about the prairie just east of Des Moines. And it was quite a great story, and we'll have you back sometime.
Great.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you so much.
Yep. And thanks for joining us today on Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo, and join us next time.